Welcome to What If, So What, the podcast where we ask what's possible with digital and figure out how to make it real in your business. I'm Jim Hertzfeld.
And I'm Kim Williams-Chopek.
We're part of Perficient's digital strategy team. And today we'll ask, what if, so what, and most importantly, now what? The Industrial Revolution of the late 1700s resulted in global, societal, and economic change. But one subtle change that doesn't get a lot of attention is it also separated the act of designing things from the act of making things. And it's not that there wasn't thought put into functionality or the aesthetics of things. It's that until then, artisans and crafters both designed and built the same things, kind of like hipster collectives in Brooklyn do today. Industrial design as we know it is credited to a guy named Raymond Loewy in the 1940s, who designed everything from pencil sharpeners to vending machines to NASA spacecraft interiors. And design has come a long way since then. And while it's table stakes for a lot of companies, it's still not quite embraced by technologists, and I would argue still misunderstood by some companies who are excited about the upside of good design and what you can get from a great design, but not really committed to everything that it takes, which is exactly why we thought would make a great discussion topic for today. We're on with Chris Bernard, VP of UX and Design at CDK Global, a company that makes software for the automotive industry. And I'm really excited to have Chris with us today. Chris, we've known each other for a few years when you were with Truth Labs, but what I've always been impressed with is, you know, I consider you sort of a lifelong design professional. And I've always enjoyed our conversations and your insights. We're really excited to have you on today.
All right. Jim, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Super. All right. Chris, let's dive in. So I want to start with, you know, I already mentioned the word design, lifelong design guy. You know, I think when we talk about design, and it's one of those words that, you know, has a lot of connotations or sort of preconceived perspectives. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But I think a lot of people sort of in the digital space, certainly in sort of technology in general, maybe the layman just think of like design as visuals of colors, shapes, and lines, and the very sort of perceptible traits of a product, you know, that sort of design to them. But I think design is so much more than that. I even think that the layperson, when they think about whether something is designed well or not, if they really think about it, it starts to formulate. But how do you think of design? How do you define design?
Sure. Well, Jim, design is one of those words that is very loaded, and it does mean a lot of different things to different people. It's kind of like engineering, right? I can be an industrial engineer. I can be a mechanical engineer. I can be a biomechanical engineer. I can be a chemical engineer. And I would say design as a discipline has different flavors as well. And probably what most lay people are most familiar with is the concept of visual or communication design. So it may be the annual report you get in the mail that you look at, or it may be the box that you open when you look at an iPhone, right? I mean, and actually an iPhone's a great way to talk about design. When you get a package with your new iPhone in it, that box is designed by someone, and the unboxing experience and how the phone is wrapped is designed, and that's communication design. And then when you actually look at the phone itself and how it's built and how they use aluminum and glass and all the different pieces that make the phone, you would call that industrial design, right? It's designing a physical thing. And I think a lot of us are familiar with that. But then when you turn on the phone and you actually have to register it, right? And you have to log in with your account and maybe restore backups from another phone, there's an experience there. And that experience is designed as well. And when you look at all of those things together and you start looking at maybe apps that you might buy on the phone, there's usually a design group that had to go in and figure out, well, how's that app going to work? How's it going to look? How's it going to feel? What steps do you have to go through to set it up? All those things are design. And even the words that we put down on the page might be designed to talk you through a process. And these are all different disciplines that encompass design, specifically when we start thinking about technology or enterprise or building software. These are all components that we bring to the table. And there's actually a few others that we bring to the table too. So there's the concept of research and going out and looking at what people are doing, asking what they're doing, seeing what they're doing to kind of help inform the design process as well.
Everyone's unboxed something, I meant, right? I love that switch you kind of made in my mind where, yeah, design went from the sort of very tangible, the unboxing experience to the, you know, using the product and then the experience itself. And yeah, it's funny you mentioned Apple because people kind of get excited about, again, they have a consumer experience around Apple. You know, Apple's done a phenomenal job, great products, you know, and Steve Jobs is iconic. But I hear so many companies say, you know, we want to be the Apple and Amazon of our industry, you know, of the food tray construction industry. You know, every esoteric sort of corner of the world. But why do you think companies are making this investment? Like, where do companies turn the corner? They've, you know, they've had a traditional business, they've had a product, they've kind of done things the same way for many years. But why do you see companies, maybe your company is in this camp, why are they investing in adopting design as a core competency?
About 10 years ago, when I worked at Microsoft, I used to give a talk called Design is the New Black. And in some ways, design has been a very trendy topic in the C-suite, in the executive suite, and in how we talk about shareholders, about creating value. And that's not to diminish it and say that it can't do those things, but by itself, it can't do those things. And I think the real reason that the companies embrace design falls across a number of dimensions. And probably the most basic one is good design can save you money, or in some cases, it can make you more money. So a really good example of that is design helps you do the right thing and pick the right path. In that regards, design can save you a lot of money over actually going down the wrong path and spending a lot of money getting down that path and then getting attached to that path and falling in love with that path because you put too much money into it. Design can help you avoid those pitfalls. So I think that's one reason that, that companies embrace design. I think the other reason that companies embrace design is because things that work well or that we like or that give us, you know, some kind of emotional or physical pleasure make us feel better. So design in some ways can hide a lot of sins or minimize them because things that make us feel good, we like to use more often. And I think even, you know, that green screen application that you might have used in a consulting company 10 years ago to book your travel gets really annoying when you go home to a world of TikTok and Facebook and, you know, Microsoft Office and Google Apps and all these things that are really well designed. So I think there's an expectation among people that technology should be friendly and adapt to them. And design is not the only ingredient, but a pretty important one to be able to accomplish that.
Yeah, I love that. So it's sort of the hard economics of it, right? I think that's lost in a lot of companies. From a consumer perspective, we bring certain expectations of design, right? I want this product to feel good. I want to feel, you know, it's sturdy, it's reliable. You know, I'm familiar with those as a consumer, but the economics are not always clear at all.
I think that's true. And I think there's different ways you can think about that and you can think about design and where it offers value. And it depends on if you're talking about something that's physical and real or something that's digital and how you think about it. But, you know, one great example is there's a wonderful company in the Chicagoland area called WeatherTech. And they make these really amazing floor mats for your car that last forever. In fact, I don't know if there's a meme or a user group called Buy It Once. I think WeatherTech would be on there. And if you go look at their website and if you go look at their products, you would think, wow, it's I don't know if these guys value design a lot or not. Looking at their website, but when you look at their products and how their products are made and what the buying process is like and the install process and how they communicate with you, it's a company that thinks about design very carefully. And it creates tremendous value in what they're bringing, which is basically extruded plastic mats for your car. And they've really used design to elevate the offering and the promise of their product in terms of how they bring it to market. Another great example of a Chicagoland company that's near and dear to me is Weber. You know, Weber makes all these wonderful grills that we've used. You probably had one in your patio when you were growing up that your parents used, and you might have one sitting out on your patio today. And the amount of design and care that they put into their products results in a product that not only looks beautiful and is super easy to use, but it's super durable. So it creates a lot of value for those products and how they work. And then in some cases, we may have products where it's a digital product and we have to sit and use that product all day long. And, you know, the frustration of a product that's poorly designed or has little nits and cuts is... it's kind of like if you're in the kitchen and you bang your head on a cabinet and it's your fault, but you just get so angry you want to punch something, right, and react to it. And bad design can be little nits and experiences that really frustrate us, even to the degree that we might not be able to articulate why we're frustrated, but it's just an experience that's thoroughly unpleasant. And if we can make those experiences easier for people, we create people that just feel better about things. And when they feel better about things, they're probably going to feel better about our product. They're probably going to feel better about their job. They're going to feel that somebody cares enough to actually focus on this. And, you know, you may even see the experience in a hotel you stay in, right? The level of attention to detail that you might get at a Four Seasons versus another hotel might be very different in terms of how they make your bed, how they fold the sheets down, what the lobby of the hotel smells like. All these things influence us in different ways, and they're all things that are designed. You asked earlier about companies, you know, do they get it or do they not? I think most companies get that design can add value, but I think maybe the industry itself, and I'm talking about my peers and myself, sometimes we don't articulate the value ourselves very well for what it can bring to the table. And sometimes if we apply the wrong methods or the wrong technique or the wrong medium to try to solve some of these problems, it's really easy for design not to solve some of the problems that people have. So a great example of that in the digital world is there's a concept, Jim, called dark patterns. Have you ever heard of that concept?
I think so. Why don't you elaborate on that?
Yeah. Dark patterns are things that you might do in technology or affordances that maybe aren't a great benefit to the end user. So there are certain social media apps that have factors in them that want to make you constantly return and use the app. They generate a FOMO, a fear of missing out, and they can drive some really unproductive behaviors with how people engage and use a product. And that's an example of a dark pattern. Or it may encourage me to not understand the privacy settings I'm setting for an experience I'm using, and unwittingly I'm disclosing a lot more information than I want to someone. Those things are dark patterns, and dark patterns are designed as well. And we have to really pay attention to those things and make sure that we're using design in a positive way to interact with the people that are ultimately going to use our products or pay for them. And quite frankly, we don't do that all the time right now. And that's where I think design sometimes can provide value for all the wrong reasons. But then also I think design, when you're applying the wrong technique to something, it's not going to solve the problem. So, one of the examples and the fundamental challenges I think we have in the automotive industry in North America is if I went and asked 10 people, what's it like to buy a car? I'm probably not going to hear very good things. It's a pretty stressful, frustrating process. People feel like sometimes they're getting hustled in that process. I'm certainly not saying the entire industry is like that, but there are parts of it that are. And a great experience in a digital product can't erase that, right? It can't erase the practice of the business or the process by itself. So design can help solve a lot of problems, but if there's other intractable things, you know, from a regulatory environment or a legal environment or just a business behavior environment, design can sometimes mask those things, but it can't make them all magically go away.
So that's there's so much there, Chris. And I'll tell you, I'm a WeatherTech guy. I just want to go back to that for a minute because it is a great product. And I probably get a new car every 2 or 3 years. And that's the first thing I do is I order my WeatherTech. So they're not a sponsor of this program, but this podcast. But I can trust it. I know it's going to work. You know, it's going to make me feel better. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with a carpenter, contractor friend of mine recently. I was just thinking, it made me think about, you know, the value of certain tools. And, you know, I asked, are these tools worth it? Can I go down to my big box store and just buy a version of this tool for $20 or $30? Or should I really go the distance and really get the best version of this that has been machined precisely, that has been tested and thought through? And if you really kind of work to those additional tools, they are easier to use. You know, if you work with them, they are truly, you know, produce a better result. They're easier. You fatigue less. You produce a better product. And it kind of goes back to the economics. I think there's certainly parallels across the board. So I wonder, kind of back to Apple again. I know that they have very iconic sort of design, way beyond Steve Jobs, but just from an aesthetic design. And I think something I do encounter with some of our clients is something I heard of termed as the Moses myth, that you're just waiting for Moses to come in and, or some heroic figure to come in and sort of part the Red Sea. And we're sort of waiting for this person to come up and this is going to be our way forward. Or there's another theme out there. You mentioned dark patterns. You may have heard of something called the cargo cult. It's kind of an agile anti-pattern where, if we just go through these certain rituals, it'll just happen. But I think it does take more, right? It does take more than, you know, setting up sort of design, called design theater. Like, hey, we're going to have a room at the lab. We're going to let people wear jeans and t-shirts, and we're going to hire a hero. It's so much more than that, right? And you kind of alluded to this with some of these other disciplines around research and some of the things you hadn't really thought of, or I think a lot of firms don't really think of. But from an organization perspective, an organization that's sort of now buying into this and maybe feels that, like, they're a little behind, how do they make it real? Like, how does an organization, or how did, you know, even you, maybe your experience at CDK, like, how do you guys make it real?
So I think I'm really fortunate at CDK right now, because I think we have completely recognized the value of design. It's absolutely not recognized in all of our products yet. That's going to be a journey that probably takes us quite a while. But I'm an executive at the company, right? So I have a seat at the table among senior leadership, which is really valuable to companies that want to really push design into their culture. But the reality is, a lot of companies don't have that, right? And they don't invest at that level. And I think the way that you make the wheel at companies today evolves around a couple of principles. And this will be kind of a complex dialogue, but I'll try to chunk it out into pieces. I think the first area that you have to work on is that the leadership of design that's going to be the most impactful in an organization is influenced leadership. Rarely does command and control work where you say, this is our new vision guy and he's in charge of the design for all our products. Well, that guy's going to be really unpopular, or that woman's going to be really unpopular if they just go around and saying, I'm in charge of all of this and I'm going to fix it. You have to build and cultivate relationships. It's just like succeeding in high school to a large degree. So I think that's the first piece that designers need to understand, is that you have to influence by leadership, and it's just not going to be given to you, and that you earn that over time. And the two most important skills that can help you do that better over time are kind of fundamental, but they're really important in the enterprise. And that's how you communicate, both in a written format, because if you can't write it down and you can't put the words around it, you probably can't articulate it beyond that. And then also how you communicate with others and how you interact with others, and the environment you create for success. There's a book that we're reading on my leadership team now that my boss gave me, called The Culture Code, which I'm sure many listeners are familiar with. And it's really about creating a safe environment and being vulnerable and understanding that not everybody has all the answers, and that even I will make mistakes sometimes as well, and that you're not expecting people to be infallible as you go through this process. What you're trying to do is reduce the cost of mistakes, and you're trying to increase the learning from mistakes that you make along the way. And the third piece of this that I think is the most important is understanding that even in the world of design, I think there's a bit of a civil war going on right now. That's a strong word, maybe too pejorative, and there's too much emotion in that word, but there's a battle that's going on. And the battle is that many designers, especially mid to senior level designers, are going through a process where they were educated in a very specific way on how to apply design, which is very waterfall-like, which is you've got to plan, you've got to research, you've got to synthesize, you've got to converge, you've got to diverge, and this will take 6 months or 12 months, and then you know what to build, so you go build it. Nobody really practices design that way in the enterprise, at least not most people that I encounter. And you also see most companies trying some attempt at agile to bring products forward. So design has really evolved towards a toolkit where we use all the same tools and we use all the same processes, but we use them in a much more accelerated way. And I think where this really came to light is some of the work that was done by Jake Knapp when he was at Google Ventures, and he wrote the book Google Sprint, which really is a book about design thinking. And it's about compressing the design thinking process into something they used to run in 5 days. And if you follow the discipline of the sprint and how it's evolved since that book was published, there's some formats that have blown it out to last a little bit longer, like maybe more like a month. But the goal is really about making smart, insightful bets and getting those things out in front of the hands of your consumers or your stakeholders to get the feedback quickly and actually start taking feedback in real time to kind of evolve your products over time. So where before I think research was critically important and time was critically important, I think today it's about efficiency of process, and it's about what are the tools at scale that we can build that can help us make better decisions. So, you know, looking at the evolution of web analytics into product analytics and eventing and tools, so I can instrument my products to give me feedback and data on how people use things, are really important. We haven't quite seen it yet in design, but when you look at what machine learning models and AI will bring to the design process, there might be certain design iterations that we can automate through a learning model in the future. And it's a concept called computational design. And I think those are aspects that are really going to fuel how we work in the future. And I'm not sure that education has quite caught up with that yet.
Yeah, that's, gosh, you covered so much ground that gets into organizational dynamics and communication and, you know, education and experience. And I just, you know, I hear design thinking a lot too, but the, you know, what I love too about the Google Design Sprint is, you know, just it makes it so practical and actionable. And I still encounter teams that we just talked about this another episode where, you know, there's a feeling of risk and uncertainty, and the response is this, I call it a design science project. Let's spend a few months sorting this out and then we'll know. But there's just no substitute for actual customer and user feedback. That's what's exciting about those approaches. And I see that catching on quite a bit. You know, I just don't see the time to market appetite, because it's 6 months to figure out what I might design, right? And then we start learning about the project. And nobody has 6 months these days, especially this year.
I have done projects just like you defined, where I come back at the end of those 6 months and I look at this and I look at our outputs, which I'm really proud of. But then I say, you know what? The market kind of moved without us in that amount of time. And what we have is no longer valid. So I think speed is important, but I think it's probably important to caveat again for some of our listeners that, you know, there are different types of design and innovation as well. And, you know, normally innovation can fall into kind of three buckets. The easiest, although I don't think any innovation is easy, is what I call evolutionary innovation, right? And that's probably what most of us make our day doing, is, you know, the incremental improvements to a product that we can add over time or a service. And then you have evolutions, right? And evolutions might be work where you're having, you know, monolithic applications to install on a computer that maybe become a SaaS offering that's a web service. And then you have what we call revolutionary design, right? Which is really upending an entire business model in a world. The techniques for revolutionary design are different than some of those other techniques that you, I would think, need for kind of the evolutionary cycles that you run through in any company. And, you know, often when we think of Apple, we think of, you know, that revolutionary design. And in some cases, it's what I would call genius design. I mean, they were very fortunate that they had Steve Jobs and they had Joni Ive there that could really see that future and articulate it. And, you know, in that case, if they went out and asked customers what they wanted, they wouldn't be able to articulate it, probably. So that's a big challenge, too. And there's that old funny joke, you know, they tell in automotive circles about Henry Ford, where if he asked what people wanted, they would have said a faster horse. But I think that's true in technology too. Nobody ever asked for the iPhone, really. You know, it took that vision to kind of articulate and paint that picture for a consumer in a way that they understood. I would say Apple probably wasn't even the first to try to do that, right? They were just the first ones that were successful doing it at scale. There's a different set of tools and techniques for all of those things that you have to think about.
So Chris, We could go on for another few hours, but I just want to say, nobody asked for the iPhone either. That's the title of your book. Just, you can.
Okay.
Yeah, you can.
I will. I'm going to write that down. You're right. That is good.
You can take it and run with it. Chris, this is so insightful. I appreciate the time today. It's so great to catch up. I think we may have to continue this again someday. But let me put you on the spot, though. Just one design element from this year you'd like to share. Favorite design element, favorite design, favorite designer. I know there are designers out there listening. What's your, we'll call it design of the year.
Let me think about that for a second. You know, the year of 2020 and the year of COVID, you know, for many of us that are fortunate, has been a world where we have the opportunity to work at home. And that opportunity comes with caveats in that you're spending a lot of time using technology to communicate and interact with people. And one of the things that I really appreciated this year was how some companies really thought about how they can humanize technology a little bit more and make it easier for all of us to work together. I love the evolution of products like Zoom. If you look at what Zoom was in February of last year and you look at what it is today, it's evolved so dramatically in so many ways. Some of those ways are focused on product quality and security. And, you know, the needs of the enterprise, but they also focused on whimsical things like, you know, Jim, if you and I wanted to have a meeting, we could both have little mustaches that look perfect on our face if we skipped Movember. And those things kind of humanize the product and the appeal. There's another company out there called Elgato, and Elgato makes a lot of products for people that use Twitch and live stream while they play games. And I found Elgato products are really great for me in all the Zoom meetings that I have to sit in and that I have to work with people every day. So I have a set of Wi-Fi controlled lights that are set up in my computer. I have a little mixer that can control my audio and my microphones. And it sounds really silly, but it allows me to make a deeper connection with the people I work with because they can see me clearly and I'm looking straight at them and I'm well lit. And I have a green screen behind me. I can put myself anywhere in the world and it surprisingly looks amazingly good. These are little design things that really elevate the way that I can communicate and interact with people in a pretty trying environment. I think, you know, what I've been most impressed about is how the industry and the world has kind of quickly evolved to kind of service that. And I can't wait till I don't have to use it, to be quite honest. But for now, while I do have to use it, it is something that I think has really impacted me greatly this year. And then I would say at home, a lot of us that, again, if you are fortunate enough that you can do your job from home as you go through this, things like mesh networking and, you know, the increase in broadband speeds in many areas of the United States have all made this possible. And I think we'll look back on it and be a little surprised how smoothly it worked for some of us, because we never thought that we were going to enter an environment like this. These industries and this technology wasn't built to support it, but it all adapted and it helped us be successful and it helped us get through a lot of this.
That's great. I can identify with all those examples. Well, Chris, again, thanks so much for sitting down with us and sharing your perspective. I know you'd go in a lot of direction. I didn't expect WeatherTech and Weber, but great call outs. So let's try and do this again.
Jim, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Now it's time for our namesake segment. What if, so what, and most important, now what? Hey, Kim. Welcome back.
Hey, Jim.
So Kim, you know, aside from having a fantastic voice, right? Chris had a lot to say, and I think we'll have him back because I think there's just so much more ground to cover. It was a pretty dense, I think, exchange. So what, a lot of things, but what kind of left out there for you?
Yeah, that was a great conversation. And dense is the right word for it. Yeah. There was a lot to think about.
Way. In the best way.
In the very best way. In the very best way. Yes. And I could listen to his voice for hours and hours. It really resonated, obviously, as you talked about in your opening, the value proposition of design is out there. It's growing. I liked his notion. He didn't say it in so many words, but you know, doing design right can actually help avoid sunk costs, but you have to follow the right approaches. And I have a lot of thoughts on that. I'm sure you do too. I thought it was pretty funny. I think he was being very kind. I love when he said the mid to senior level designers, which I think is just a nice way of saying older designers. You know, we're trained in a certain way or in a certain discipline, and they're so insistent on following waterfall processes and this notion of it has to be pixel perfect and I can't show you something until I think it's ready. Mm-hmm. And it just can't work like that anymore. And I think we've seen it, and he's right. You know, when you think like that, the market moves without you. And that's what we have to get away from.
Yeah, I'm glad you worked that in there, Kim, because it's such cliche, time is money. And you know, we used to talk about just the value of getting something to market quickly, just so you can make money off of it, right? So you can recoup your investment. But I think what was coming up was actually, that's true. You know, you want to monetize your work, but the world's changing, right? Even in 6 months, you know, those needs are going to change. And I think that's more compelling.
Right. And how do you really adjust to that? And that, you know, tends to be more of a culture change. But, you know, I think maybe his implication is, maybe younger designers, you know, who haven't been trained in, I'll just say dogma, you know, that they are a little bit more flexible. And this notion of the design sprint that he talked about, you know, the broader design thinking and how that's actually operationalized. I've used the Google design sprint methodology in a product company. I love it. I loved it. It forced designers, technologists, product managers totally out of their comfort zone. It made them, it forced them see their intended users in live, real action. It helped them really move away from that goal of pixel perfectness. I can't speak highly enough for kind of, I'd say forcing that, you know, in smaller chunks with certain teams to see if you can really move the needle on how companies think about design and how they really think about placing the value on certain processes.
So I'm overanalyzing the phrase pixel perfect, and I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with that. And is it right? Is it perfection? Because I think it's perfection, right? Like perfect is the enemy of good.
And yes.
And
yes.
Right. That's and right. So there's a flaw. But then I think about pixel, you know, is the visual, the aesthetic, right? And I think that's also underlies some of the flaws here, because I think one of my big takeaways was Chris got out onto this right away, was that design is many different things. And I know we've talked about this and I've written about this, that is way beyond the aesthetics. And he opened up with talking about the different types of design, communication design and industrial design and experience, even getting down to the unboxing. By the way, you know, we recently just came out of the holidays as of this recording. I had a couple great unboxing experiences, right?
Well, it makes a difference, right? And he's right. Yeah. You know, all the different types of design, but I think you're right. It's this notion, let's think about pixel perfect more broadly. It's not just about the aesthetics. It's exactly like you said, you can't let perfect stand in the way of good. That's the whole notion behind Agile.
Right, right. Well, and then bringing, and we're seeing this more and more, especially under, we've talked about this in our episode with Jeff Small around product management, right? It is this merging of Agile and design thinking and how those loops converge and merge together. And I think it just goes back to businesses becoming, design and IT are not two different departments. Businesses become digital. This has to be a core competency. You know, design is especially customer experience design is just, it's got to be a core competency in every business. You know, so we're dealing with this battle between waterfall and lean, but you know, it's not a battle between two teams, the IT team and the design team. Sometimes I feel like it's friction between both of those teams and where businesses need to be, right? They both need to evolve.
Right. Because theoretically their goal is the same, bring a good product to market, make our users happy. But how we get there, how we're measuring, how we're placing values, how we're staffing teams, what are the skill sets, all of that kind of leads to that internal friction. And really, I think ultimately the delay in achieving those goals.
So Kim, speaking of friction, it makes me think of the what if for this episode. So if you don't mind, let me jump into that, because I think my what if, if you think about design and I'm thinking about how as an organization, design becomes my core competency. For me to buy into that, I have to start asking, what would I be? What could I do? What could I be differently? What is the what if of good design? I think of it in sort of three competing questions that belie this friction. And this kind of comes from IDEO's three lenses of innovation. I know you've heard this, the balance between desirability, viability, and feasibility. And I feel like it's so brilliant. It's just so fundamental to me. That's such a fantastic explanation. But with great design, you could manage these three questions. You could ask really three what if questions. Like, what if you could give customers exactly what they need? I think design helps us understand and expose what the customers need. Secondly, what if you could give the business what it wants, right? It has to make sense. Well, is it viable? Will it make money? Not just desirable by our customers. Is it viable? And then, lastly, what if you could actually build it? Is it feasible? Can you do it? Is it technically possible? I think good design discipline, good experience design discipline, I've seen this on teams and on projects that I think have done a really good job of adopting design, really ingesting it into the approach. Those are the three what ifs that they're resolving. So what if you could do that, Kim?
Well, no. So let's think about how you might accomplish those what ifs, because I think they're good what ifs, and those principles of innovation are the underpinnings. First of all, as Chris mentioned, research is key to the design process, and that's often overlooked. It's important for identifying not only what customers need, but who they are. And that's going to help you answer, what if you could give customers exactly what they need? You can't figure that out without research. And I've seen plenty of product managers, design products and guide teams based on their opinion. And ultimately, that's a failure. And, Chris made another good point that I'll bring up here. Design needs a seat at the senior leadership table. And while I agree with Chris's assertion that good design leadership comes through influence, communication, interaction, I still think too many designers are missing the data and the proof points. It's really and maybe these are these mid to senior level designers, but there has to be a why behind the design. There has to be data. There has to be a benchmark that you're looking at. And this can come through research, but designers have to get better about being comfortable about thinking a little bit more about that monetization, that tracking, reporting results, picking a data point, and really working with the team to design against that. And implicitly, and this is a bigger conversation, I really think that if you're a product company, you need to be product led. And I'm contrasting that with marketing led or sales led. It's an organizational model, but it really allows you to address the first two what ifs. A company, that is product led, like WeatherTech and Weber, are successful because they can address those what ifs and allows them to be agile and respond to their customer needs without worrying about sales implications or marketing implications directly, because they're innovating their product based on customer needs and not necessarily based on a sales goal or a marketing goal. What do you think? That just feels to me like, as I was listening to Chris and thinking about the conversation, I love the WeatherTech and the Weber examples. They're product-led companies.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a fan of both. I'm a customer of both.
I heard.
Yeah.
You really buy new WeatherTech? Well, I guess you have to, right? They cut and measure everything.
It's the first thing I do, like that day. I've had my current vehicle for 2 years, and that's the first thing I did.
It's amazing. But I mean, these are all big things, but what could you do today? You can't change, your company from being marketing led to product led. You can't, decide to train all your designers on Google Analytics tomorrow. I mean, you could, but these are bigger changes.
Yeah. And that's, like we said in the beginning, there was such a density of thought in our interview. I thought a lot about this because there's so many things that I want to do, and you're right. Influence takes a lot of time, right? And it's changing hearts and minds, right? Or winning hearts and minds. But I think one of the things that we've said this, sort of bigger change management strategies, Kim, right? We say, even with all the research and the great in design, there's got to be proof. Research is great, but another element of research is testing, right? And getting that feedback, and that's the proof that people need. When people see that, wow, that team really embraced a great balance of design and agile and testing and research, and it works. They want to know how it happened. So I think one of the things that I'm going to jump on the sprint bandwagon too. I think that's one thing I think people can do, and I want to leave people with kind of one challenge. Take a use case and give yourself 5 days. What can you do with it? I think, adopting a Google Sprint or what we call Perficient, a CX AMP, how do you adopt that in 5 days? How do you take an idea, figure out what customers want, build some basic empathy, prototype it, test and share it, try to make it work in some way, get more feedback, and see what you learned on Friday afternoon that's different than what you assumed on Monday morning. I think that's an exercise that everybody can do. Dip your toe in that water. And I think it will change hearts and minds. I really believe that. And I've seen it work. And the other thing, it's fun, right? I just think it's just more enjoyable. So I think that's a now what. Get out there, 5 days, try it out. You won't regret it. Just like this interview. Which we could talk for 5 days, but anyway, thanks, Kim. And we're going to do this again.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go do a design sprint.
Yeah, let's go. It's Wednesday here, but we got a couple days. We'll do
That's
it.
That's right.
All right.
Thanks, Jim.
You've been listening to What If So What with Jim Hertzfeld and Kim Williams-Chopek. Subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss a single episode. You can find this season along with show notes at Perficient.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, Google, and other major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.